jump into the epic world of Avatar: The Last Airbender.
With Nickelodeon's official companion podcast, Avatar: Braving the Elements.
Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Listen to Avatar: Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
Listen to MTV's official challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert.
You can feel it in the room. You can feel it in the room already. Because, folks, my guest tonight is, well, he's a rock star who has given his voice to U2 and the fight for equality around the world. He's just written a new memoir, Surrender, 40 Songs, One Story. Please welcome to The Late Show, Bono.
Thank you.
Would you please guess first?
What have I said now?
We'll do it this way, then. If you want to do it.
Have you ever done a stand-up interview?
I've never actually done a stand-up interview.
Let's go.
Let's do it. Okay. We're going to do the interview standing up.
Yeah.
All right.
Because I'm Irish and I can do what I want,
all
okay?
Right. All right. It's really lovely to meet you. I've never had you on the show before.
It's also... Yeah. Also, such a pleasure to meet you, sir.
The thing is that this isn't the first time we've been in a room together, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Rosemont Horizon outside of Chicago, 1987, Joshua Tree tour. I was there. I was the guy in the 25th row of the orchestra right before Sunday Bloody Sunday who went, woo! That was me.
I knew I'd meet you one day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
You can sit down
Thank
now,
you
sir.
Very much.
You were in the 25th row.
25th row of the orchestra, baby. I had a lighter. Remember, I was the guy with the lighter.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a pretty fun night, I gotta
say. Self-immolation. Goes very well with rock and roll. You set yourself on fire that night.
Sure. Now, good. I don't even know where to begin, man. I don't know where to start with a Bono. It's too rich of a feast for me right now. So let's just start with a book.
Dropped on my head when I was a baby.
Sure. Get in line. All right. So here is the new book, Surrender, 40 Songs, One Story. As everyone knows, you are the lead singer of U2. There you are with the lads. Larry Mullen Jr. on drums, Adam Clayton bass, Bono on vocals, and The Edge. But what I want to talk to you about, and you get into it in the book, is take me back to London, take me back to Dublin in the 70s. Talk to me about these guys. Talk to me about these fellas right here. What was it like meeting these fellas for the first time?
Clearly a potty mouth. Mm-hmm. The Edge bought a guitar the same shape as his head. Big brain, cut jaw. Larry Mullen, proper rock star from day one.
What do you mean by proper rock star?
Well, he got a drum kit from his dad, Larry Mullen Sr., by pretending he was interested in jazz. And because that's what the dad was going to, you know.
Sure.
And have you noticed Larry Mullen Jr. is not exactly a punk rock name.
Yes.
Much more jazz.
Yes.
So he formed the band. And
he was
14 years old, put up the notice in Mount Temple Comprehensive Rock and Roll High School. And, I met all four members of U2 and my present and only woman of my life, the love of my life, my wife, the same week. I went out the same week.
That's a big week.
Yeah, it was a big week.
What week? What week of the year? What month of the year are we talking?
It was November when we finally, went out. I was at a bus stop.
Wow.
And, the sky did not crack, but we attempted.
You're talking about your wife here?
Yes.
Okay,
I'm also betrothed to Edge, Adam, and Larry, but it's a different kind of relationship.
Yes, but just as committed.
But I'm happy to get into it with you also.
Well, I hope we will. But first, I want to talk to you about... can we talk about the hair for a second? Because this is the first guy I saw.
Oh, wow.
That is. Okay. when did this guy show up?
The mullet, I think, is what you're referring to.
The mullet, exactly, yes.
Yes, in the decade Taste Forgot, the 80s, the mullet was a kind of a David Bowie lab experiment that went wrong. We all thought we were going to get it like David Bowie. It didn't really look like that. And a man should really not look like his hair has been ironed, I don't think.
Well, this was big. This spread far and wide. My roommate in college, a guy named Eric Jones, he loved you so much. This is his haircut that he got.
Wow.
Yeah. We listened to nothing but U2 in my room. If I didn't like U2, I would have had to have moved out of the room. Because that's all we listen to.
I'd like to think we've moved into your room right now. I'm very happy about that.
Thank you for being here.
Mm-hmm. Our youngest son, John, who's unfortunately for me 6 foot, has presently a mullet.
Oh, really?
And yes, we were getting on so well. But
is he a musician?
No.
Oh, he just wants a mullet.
He just arrived in with a mullet and... yeah, I wouldn't mess with them.
There's a lot of comeback of the mullet. The New York Times is saying there's a search for the best mullet in America.
Wow.
Right now. Los Angeles Times says the mullet is the haircut that refuses to die. Have you thought about growing it back?
No, it upsets me.
It upsets you that you ever had one, like seeing you with a mullet?
We're all dealing with shit, you know? And,
Dark chapters from our past.
Can you imagine Live Aid, one of the most incredible moments of anyone's life, you know, as a concert? By famine. Sure. Organized by my mate Bob Geldof and, you know, Queen and, mm-hmm. and just incredible artists, you know, in Philadelphia and London and broadcast all over the world. And I see that back now, I just go, oh.
Would you be at all interested in seeing what it would look like to have it back? Because we have the digital technology to give you a mullet right here in this moment.
We were getting on so well.
Yes.
How are you going to do this?
You just kind of look over at that camera, and then this camera is going to put a mullet on
your
head.
I look at this camera?
You look at that, but then you look at that camera, but then this camera is going to put a mullet on you, okay? Jim, can we mullet him?
Wow.
Can you zoom out a little bit? It's a little big. It's a little big. Can you look at me a little bit, Bono? Look at me
just
right there. That's perfect. That's it. Nice.
Very, very hurtful.
As you've got this tremendous stage presence, and it's very unique. Like, it's identifiable, you know, a Bono performance, not just the voice, but your physicality. Were there people when you were younger, when this guy, this, you know, these young guys right here, was there somebody that this guy admired as a performer that you wanted to model yourself after, the same way like Mick Jagger modeled himself after like Tina Turner? He did. He took his dancing from her.
Well, that's interesting, because I had a female kind of muse in terms of as a performer, somebody I would really, who changed my view of performing, Patti Smith, great poet. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I really loved about her was that you felt with her, there was no distance between her and her audience. We were in her audience. And that, you know, sometimes she would elbow her way through the crowd and get up on stage or elbow her way out of the crowd. And I like performers who, you know, I sense for them that they want to break down the fourth wall, the distance. They might follow you home. They might sit in your knee. They might make you a cup of tea. They might mug you. They might make out with you. You know,
But they're part of it. They're not just observers for you.
Yeah, they're in it. Mark Rylance, a great actor. Mm-hmm. I saw him in Jerusalem, and I just felt he could step right off the stage and into my life. And so that's, for me, yeah. For performers who are nicely comfortable above everyone else was what we rebelled against in the late 70s in what has become known as punk rock, though somebody did shout at an early show of U2, more punk in the Monkees.
More punk in the Monkees?
Meaning?
More in you. You're the Monkey?
Well, there was... It happened before your time.
I know, the Monkees. You mean like the Monkees? We come walking down the street. Get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Okay, yeah, you got it. Oh, wow.
It's a hair trigger. They're on a hair trigger right now.
But it was just a heckle. And so we weren't really convincing as a punk band because we were children. But those values were and are still at the core of who we are.
What are those values? What do you see those as, those punk values?
A sort of punk rock promise.
Yeah, what is it?
Well, I think to understand that your audience are... That you came out of the audience, that you were there with them, for them, that you're not above them.
It's a reciprocal emotional relationship.
Yeah, and I would say also... we had in punk this idea that music can change the world and you can have fun. That was a sort of feeling in punk rock music. You know, it wasn't just, you know. And, yeah, that the world is more malleable than you think. You know, you can bend it and shape it. It's not set. That idea, you know, three chords, you say your truth, you speak your truth, you spit it out, and... I would say hip-hop it came in that same spirit, you know, with black music. But it's, you know, the only limit was your imagination, not your ability to play. Like, these are such extraordinary musicians. But we were not. I mean, The Edge was a genius. Larry could play drums. Adam was bluffing. but he looked great.
Sure.
But, these kind of punk rock promises, I think we've tried to keep them. It doesn't look like that. But our bands, our crew, the community we've come from in Dublin and Ireland, we're still with these people. So we're children of punk, Stephen.
I read back in, like, 1984, 1985, I think it was in Cream magazine, they'd have these profiles of artists, bands, and it would be, like, the same questions they ask every band. Mm-hmm. And band you'd like to be, or you wish you were, or something like that. I think y'all said the Beatles. Or you might have said the Who.
Could be the Who, could be the Beatles. I'll take either, mate.
I think it might have been the Who. Yeah. But then I looked up what the Who said, and the Who said the Beatles. Uh-huh. And the Beatles said the Beach Boys, and the Beach Boys said Chuck Berry. So did you two want to be Chuck Berry? By the transitive property of rock.
I hadn't you down as a mathematician, but I think there's an equation in there.
Yeah. Is there, like, an early rock and roll influence? You like Elvis Presley.
Yeah, big bang of pop music, of course.
Sure, yeah. Do you ever sing his stuff? Like, do you ever...
First time my mother... Only time my mother ever heard me singing was in our high school gym. And it was the... It was an Elvis part in the musical Joseph and His Amazing...
It's the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh is the Elvis part, yeah.
Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, that's right. And you had to curl your lip, and it was my mother's trouser suit. I guess I was 14, and she put sort of, you know, Diamante shit on it. And I had to go, I was wandering along on the banks of the river, you know. And, you know... I actually could quite pull it off. I felt a bit of the Flash coming. And I was, ooh, this crown. Ooh, I like this crown. And she just laughed and laughed and laughed. And that was the only time she saw me. So, yeah, I feel close to the king. What about yourself?
Oh, I love him. I grew up with him all throughout the house. Wise men say...
Only fools rush in. But I can't. Falling in love with you. Well, What I can't just figure out is how a truck driver from Memphis, 16 years old, was wearing eyeshadow, was wearing those zoot suits, you know, and those, you know...
pointy shoes.
Blue suede shoes, I guess. But, you know, just think about that, you know, 15 or 16 in Memphis. I mean, even now, in New York, you get a few looks. Mm-hmm. And he's got that, and I think there was a revolution going on there, not just in music, but just in the way of thinking and, you know, what he did for kind of a femininity that he owned up to as well as a masculinity. Mm. And, yeah, I don't think we fully understand Elvis even now. It's still going on. And I love, you know, I know the early period of Elvis is the one that people revere, you know? Mm. When he looked like Rudolph Valentino and sang mm-hmm. like Dean Martin, but Love Me Tender and all that. But actually, it's the end of his life when he got lost that he became more than even a rock and roll singer. I think he became like an opera. And him singing, what is it?
The Wonder of You.
Well, the American Trilogy, I was thinking, this sort of glory, glory.
Battle
Hymn. Hallelujah is truth. And he's sweating and he... forgetting some of the words and his, but I just see him as an epic American story, and his vulnerability in the end was what made him great. Though I remember saying this to Chuck D from Public Enemy, and he said his line was, "Elvis don't mean shit to me," and I guess, you know, it's a very particular love, but when you have it, you'll never be. You'll never be released from it. So if you've got it, you'll have it bad, I'm sure.
Well, speaking of people that you love and you never stop loving, did you see the Peter Jackson Get Back documentary?
And yeah, the Beatles.
The reason I ask is not just the Beatles, because of course the Beatles. But what I love is hearing how artists and great artists go through their process of suddenly there's nothing and suddenly there is something. Substantial and beautiful and that is like a magic wand and moves people, gets into their heart from a distance. And I'm curious, when you look at that, what is your process like, I guess is what I'm asking? Because that process was so fascinating to me. And did you recognize anything in their process in the way that you and your friends here in the band create songs?
I was riveted. I mean, first of all, who knew that the Beatles had created reality TV? I was like, wow. They had microphones in the flower pots and...
Right.
And then I also felt so privileged because it was like being there when Jesus wrote, you know, the Sermon on the Mount. And if Jesus had a roadie, he'd be like, blessed are the, blessed are the meek. I mean, you're hearing them write these songs.
Sure, sure, sure.
And they're going, what is it, you know?
Yes.
It's like, hey, George, no, Jude, or whatever, you know.
You're yelling, Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah. Improvisation's at the heart of what U2 does, even though there's a formal songwriting that we do. Mm-hmm. Edge and myself really do that. But for Larry and Adam, their contribution in the songwriting is often through improvisation. Mm-hmm. And improvisation started very early for me. I can remember as a child, couldn't play. I remember my head being up to the piano keys, mm-hmm. so I couldn't see. I remember putting my foot on the reverb pedal, pressing, you know, finding a note, and then finding another one that would sound good with that note. And that's improvisation. It's faith, actually. You're jumping from one place to another. You don't know how you're going to get there. And in music, that's how, you know, that's how we live. You know, you're finding those notes. I've never sung, you know, these songs the way I'm singing them now. I've never sung them before. Every night, it's different for me. But there's also improvisation in just the way you deal with your situation. I was writing in my book about being... No, I was writing in my book about... thank you. When we were kids, looking very much like that photograph, we had a big TV producer... Big Cheese was coming to our high school because he'd heard we wrote our own songs. And it was a big break. We were going to get our break and get on the national telly. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were arguing about how the song was going, and it was really not going anywhere. All this, none of the songs, we couldn't agree on anything. There's a knock on the door like that. And we're like, what are we gonna do? What are we gonna do? How do we, what do we say? What do we do? What are you doing? And he walks in and he's, so you write your own songs. How old are you? What, 15, 16 years old? Yeah, we write our own songs. Could you play me one? Now, improvisation led Edge to look at me like that, and I looked at him like that, Adam and Larry, and we played the Ramones' Glad to See You Go and said it was ours. That's improvisation, too. And
geniuses steal. Everyone borrows, geniuses steal.
Yeah.
I want to...
We changed it around when we got on. We actually did get the appearance on TV, and then we changed it to one of our songs. Just so you know.
More with Bono after this.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game, headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
You write beautifully about your parents in here. And if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to your mother. You said there's only one time she saw you perform.
Mm-hmm.
She passed when you were 14,
yeah.
I believe. What now, with the perspective of your age, because it takes a long time to absorb the death of a parent and understand what that meant to you, I think. What did your mother mean to you, and what did her passing mean to you, and I suppose affect your art or add to your art?
Well, you're asking about kind of performers I'm attracted to. I think, I'm not saying I'm a great performer, but great performers really need their audience. I need the U2 audience. And I think they feel that. They know that. And that can sound vomit-inducing, by the way. You know, we love you. You're amazing. I'm not saying that. I'm saying something deeper than that is the desire to have that hole filled that's left when I lost my mother is what brought me there to music. And that wound sort of was an opening in a way. It opened me up, not just to music, but to being a performer. And I, you know, I'm an easy study. You know, it's quite obvious that I fill that hole, you know, with everyone here and every night U2 goes on stage. But there's another layer of this, which is contemplating. You're forced to contemplate a concept that a 14-year-old finds very hard to contemplate. The concept of infinity. You know, is there such a thing? Is there an eternal spirit? Where has my mother gone? Where am I going? And so, great fun stuff like that. But these are the things, you know, that get you there and you ask these questions. And our band, somebody said, you know, say Van Morrison started off writing songs about girls and ended up years later writing about God. Mm-hmm. With us, we sort of started with God and we're just getting to girls now. But it's, you know, we ask those big questions in our... It's the opera in us, too.
I have a question about Van Morrison that we can cut out. I'm just curious, since I got you here. I've always thought the song Domino is about God.
Oh.
Do you think that?
Yeah.
Don't want to discuss it? Think it's time for change? You may get disgusted, start thinking that I'm strange. In that case, I'll go underground and get some heavy rest. Never have to worry about what is worse, what is best. Oh, Domino, oh, Lord. Yeah. Roll me over now, Romeo, the great lover.
Yeah,
that's I've always thought of that as his...
I think you're right. And, you know, when I hear him sing, it's like the angels singing for me. Mm-hmm. For Irish people in particular, mm-hmm. Van Morrison means so much to us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, meeting him, you know, it's like, you know, he can be in strange form. He said of me, he knew I was his absolute, you know, a disciple. He said, "You'll be great when you're finished."
What do you think he meant by that?
You'll get there one day. You know.
But right before the end?
Yeah.
Do you think you're there yet?
I'll tell you a story. You cannot put it on the air, but just it's so funny.
Keep for a second. Rolling. Go ahead. Obviously, we're going to cut this out.
So, Van Morrison, it's like meeting, you know, God for me. And with my family, we go backstage. We're in Nice at the Jazz Festival. And Van Morrison says to me, "Want to do Gloria?" So Gloria is one of the greatest songs ever written, right? It's like your dad saying, "Do you want to take the car out?"
Sure, sure.
I'm like, "Yeah." And so we go on stage, and I know, and he's in amazing form. He sings 7 new songs no one's ever heard. The crowd are going with it. And then something puts him off. I don't know what. You know, it can happen to us all. The wine turns to vinegar. Anyway, whatever happened, I knew, be careful. You know, I'm going to sing this. Don't want to screw this up. After an hour, no matter who you are, Van Morrison, the crowd love something. A guest comes on stage. Yeah. So he goes, "Right, Bono is on stage." And so I walk out on stage in Nice, which I love Nice, and they love you too. So the crowd goes off, and I'm singing G, L, and the crowd, "Oh, whoa, 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 whoa," boom. Van, the man's gone. He's gone. He left. He just walked out. And I'm like, let's close this show. So he closed the show, but I don't think you can use that, but... He's not litigious, is he? No,
what?
He's
no.
A great man.
No. I'm sure he doesn't. Neither is Disney. Now...
Oh.
Okay.
I can feel some personal hurt there.
What?
Nothing.
Show business, baby.
Okay.
It's all show business.
Okay.
We all love each other.
Mm.
Now, midterms are next week in the States here. And our country's casting a vote about its future, a very kind of interesting one now because of what's going on with our approach or our view of democracy
right.
and the validity of our elections. You're a longtime lover of the U.S., and you say in the book, you call America perhaps the greatest song the world has not yet heard. What do you mean, and what's that song sound like to you?
Well, what I mean is, and I think I'm really encouraged by this idea that America doesn't yet exist. It's the greatest idea the world has ever had, but I don't think it's here yet. And that's an amazing feeling that it's just being written and far from recorded. And, you know, the people in this, you know, this generation, the people in this room can write what America is. And, you know, some people look back and think that America has had its heyday. No, it's all coming for you. You're just being created. And think about it. You know, if you're not a native American, there's no DNA test that can tell you you're an American. I mean, if you do a DNA test here, anyone here, you'll be one part Polish, one part, you know, whatever. You know, one part Czech, one part Egyptian, we know. But there's no DNA test will tell you you're American unless you're a native. And that's kind of That's who you are. You're not... The American is just being created. And I'm excited by that.
Are you saying that it'll be good when you're finished? Is that what you're saying to America?
Yes. And what I do want to say is, I've been everywhere in this country, even in my imagination. You know, I've been to Bozio, Idaho. I've been everywhere, but the band has brought me everywhere. And there is nowhere in this country that I would want to fly over. I'm interested in all the Americans that I've met. I've met a lot. And I'm friends and in community with conservatives. And as a sort of, you know, bleeding heart liberal that I am, I enjoy those conversations. I enjoy those arguments. It's just essential that they stay as arguments and not the kind of brutality that we've witnessed in the last week with Paul Pelosi and Nancy Pelosi, because... And it was even the hammer. It was a hammer. You know, this blunt instrument. It's an image I can't get out of my head. And, you know, I just feel that all of us are better than any of us. And, you know, the one campaign we work with, our idea is that you don't have to agree with somebody on everything if the one thing you care about is important enough. And so, you know, I just think we need to listen to each other more. And, you know, I'm a big talker. That doesn't come easy for me, listening. But I think we need to listen to each other more and try to understand what's going on. But yeah, America's on its way, and I'm just so excited to see how, you know, where you take it. And this is difficult times, but you know, in these, you know, trying times, these anxious times, you know, you always choose, you always find leadership to match the moment. If you go back to the war and Truman, or before the Second World War, you think of FDR, or I think of Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. And I just think America will find that leadership. And if you don't like what's going on in the Capitol, and, you know, local communities, you'll find that leaders will arrive in local communities. I would never underestimate, you know, small town America. There's no such... This idea of flyover country makes me rich. I love actual America.
I agree.
And actual Americans. Mm.
I toured for many years. There's no town that I didn't find fascinating.
Is that right? Where? Yeah. What, as a
comedian, I toured all over.
See, that's
United
the same
States.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
on a
van.
A van. Bus.
A van with
yeah,
a bunch
yeah.
Of,
yeah. Same
yeah.
thing.
Yeah. There was no town. There was one town. They stole my writing partner's clothes. That was the one town from the laundromat. That was the one town that we left with a bad taste in our mouth. Every other town was just fantastic. I'm not going to say where that was.
But
where was that? What? It wasn't Lincoln, Nebraska. Lincoln, Nebraska is a great town. I had a girlfriend from there.
I had an amazing moment in Lincoln, Nebraska. We did an AIDS speaking, working, called the Heart of America tour. Because, you know, if you're an American, you're an AIDS activist. I don't know if you know that. It's an amazing thing, because your country really leads the world fighting HIV/AIDS. And conservative President Bush kicked that off. Mm-hmm. Then President Obama followed through on it, and mm-hmm. right through to Biden. And I skipped that bit.
But one of the greatest things Bush did.
It's an extraordinary thing. And on this tour, mm-hmm. on a van and a bus, actually, mm-hmm. This guy walks in, and he's introduced to us as the richest man in America. His name is Warren Buffett. Mm-hmm. And he's, oh, hi, wow. And I asked him, he's known as the Oracle of Omaha, you know. And I asked him, have you any advice? And he said, two things. What are you asking people to do? And I said, well, you know, they write their congressman, you know, on these postcards and mm-hmm. send it to him. It's too easy. People don't trust you if you ask them to do things too easy. ask them to do 10 postcards each. I said, well, this is good. What else? He said, don't appeal to the conscience of America. Appeal to the greatness of America, and you'll get the job done. And I believe
that. Beautiful.
I really believe that, because, you know, we're Irish people, you can guilt us into with other people. But in America, if you're really stuck, like, say, we were in the Second World War, Americans show up. You're the cavalry. We love that about you.
The book is Surrender, and there's one thing in the book I'd like to return to before we go here. And you did something that was very generous. You actually, you apologize in this book.
Right.
You apologize for putting U2's 2014 album, Songs of Innocence, onto every iPhone in the world without our permission. And you say unequivocally, this was my fault, my idea. Apple questioned it. I said, no, it's going to be great. The band didn't want to do it. I wanted to do it. I was wrong. That's very fulsome of you. And now I understand in your next book, you have other things to apologize for. And we have a list of them right here. Is this true, Bono?
Did you know that Edge was from the future?
He is?
Yeah, he says it's better.
Oh, yeah.
So go ahead.
Here we are. This is a little something. Here they are right there.
What do
also,
I do?
They're also going to be in these cameras right here.
Okay.
This is something we like to call apologies to look forward to in Bono's next book. Take it away.
Okay.
Start right over there.
I'd like to apologize for wearing sunglasses. You see, when I take them off, I shoot lasers out of my eyes like Cyclops from the X-Men. Our 2004 album, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, does not actually contain instructions as to how to dismantle an atomic bomb. Just 11 really great songs. I'm sorry, because after we released The Unforgettable Fire, I totally forgot about the fire. That's good.
That's good.
During the encore, I said to 30,000 applauding fans, I can't hear you, Minneapolis. I lied. I could hear them fine.
Oh.
I can hear them fine.
Yeah.
To my bandmates, Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen Jr., I'm sorry you're stuck working with guys who call themselves Bono and The Edge. I didn't realize we could just use our real names.
Bono, everybody. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert. Just one more thing. If you want to see more of me, come to The Late Show YouTube channel for more clips and exclusives.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Enjoying this episode of The Late Show Pod Show? Then head to cohst.app/lateshow or visit the link in the description to fill out our quick 2-minute survey all about getting to know you.